The following podcast is a member of the Great Big Owl family.
Jalan, 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 again.
It's my Mate Bottle Toaster. Hello, welcome along. This week, I am so excited to welcome a man who very much, he wrote his own invitation to be on this podcast. A fabulous, fabulous writer and columnist. It's the brilliant Tim Dowling. Hello, Tim. Welcome
Hello.
To my Mate Bottle Toaster.
It's a pleasure to be here.
And this is your own fault
yeah.
because you did a column where you talked about how much Amazon you've been doing during lockdown. And I read it. Three separate members of my family messaged me saying, the brilliant Tim Dowling has been doing loads of shopping on Amazon. You need to get him on your podcast.
It's going to turn out that I bought four things or something.
Yeah, we'll discover that. We'll discover that. But it's worth saying, Tim, I mean, the thing I do is I dive right back into the beginning of your Amazon journey.
Okay.
This isn't going to be nice. And I am thrilled, absolutely thrilled, that I think this is only the second or third time this has happened on the 40 plus episodes of this podcast. We've gone back to the 90s.
Yeah, that's perfectly possible.
A very early adopter.
Maybe I'm just the oldest person you've ever had on your show.
I don't know about that, but you were onto the Amazon thing in the 90s, which is great news for me, because we can see what you've been buying. Oh, look at this. So straight away, 28th of January, 1999. I mean, what were you doing that day?
28th of January, 1999. I have no idea. One of my children would have just turned one. And the other one, third of the three, wasn't born yet.
Right. Okay.
I was probably changing nappies.
Two kids in. Well, that's right. Well, yes. There are no nappies bought at this stage because Amazon is very much books
and that sort of stuff. Right?
So it's really only books until about it kicks off later on. But the first thing you ever bought, David Sedaris.
Oh, which one? That's the first one I ever read, I think.
Well, there you go. And we're there now. We're seeing it happen. I mean, David Sedaris, absolute genius. Did he inspire you in terms of his writing?
He was one of those awful things because that was fully, 7 or 8 years before I started writing a column for The Guardian. And I just remember my wife laughing hysterically at it whenever she read it. And I thought, well, who's she reading? Who's funnier? Who she thinks is so, so funny. I'm thinking I would have been so impressed by the miracle of Amazon, just having that arrive on my doorstep whenever it was.
Yeah. It's an incredible moment, isn't it?
I remember exactly a friend of mine recommending that book to me, and I knew nothing about it. And it was very funny and very odd because those first David Sedaris books were sort of a mishmash of sort of fiction and memoir, just little short chapters. And so I was like, who is this guy? And I think I suddenly realized, I'd heard his voice at some point coming out of Radio 4 and not known who he was. And I've since gone to see him speak. And I'll tell you what, the thing that really, he's one of those people who I consider to be a sort of, I wouldn't say mentor, just someone I copy from when I have to do public speaking, because he has this great way, he doesn't do any voices, It's just his voice. And he reads out dialogue that other people are saying, but he just doesn't bother with any kind of dramatic. And it's still good.
Yeah. And it still works, doesn't it? To dial back to an image you just planted in my head, which won't leave, and I want to come back to talking about the brilliant David Sedaris. And this is something that happens to me when I write Odds and Sods, is my wife reading it and then there's a laugh. When there's a laugh, you're like, what was that?
Yeah.
Which bit was that? Is this something you have? Does your wife regularly read your stuff? And if so, do you have the paranoia of pacing nearby?
I don't. She reads what I write when it comes out, and I hopefully I'm still asleep in bed or I've left the room. Depends on who gets up first. But sometimes, it used to be I remember the first, because I took over the page from John Ronson in 2007. I do remember her kind of, and that was back when we used to get the papers delivered every morning. And I remember her sitting up in bed and just sighing and saying, God, I miss John Ronson. And
She sounds like a keeper. She sounds great.
But yeah, she does read what I write, and she doesn't read it until sort of day of publication, so it can be quite hairy.
Mm. Yeah. This is the problem. This is the problem with loved ones who are honest. This is why we need other halves who just maintain some sort of illusion. It's much easier. It's much easier. David Sedaris, though, absolutely brilliant. You also gone for him again in February. So January, you bought David Sedaris in February 1999. You've gone naked.
I've gone from sort of having no idea who he was to stalker in the space of.
That's it. Yeah. 28 days. And you bought The Brilliant House of Sleep by Jonathan Coe. Mm-hmm. Fabulous book.
Very good.
And then we can tell there are kids involved here. Look, we've got An Atlas of Countries by Donald Grant of February 1999.
That is me just hot-housing my oldest child. Yeah. I've never seen that book again.
Has it worked?
No, I imagine he hid that somewhere. Yeah, I mean, but it's like creating a Frankenstein. Don't do it. You don't want someone to grow up to be that much smarter than you.
This is the danger, isn't it? You don't want a smart aleck.
I can't win an argument against him.
Oh, don't. You see, I can't really win an argument against myself. and along my kids have come, and finally I've had this authority, but my eldest one is now 8 and he's starting to better me. And I don't know where I go from here, really.
No, there's no place to go but down, I promise you. And then they can start beating you at sort of games of skill and chance. And then it's just
ridiculous.
I mean, they were better at football than I was when they were sort of 8 and 9, because I did not grow up with the sport.
Well, thank you. I've got exactly the same problem. My eldest is a self-styled hotshot at football, and he can do keepy uppies into double figures.
Oh, see, I can barely do one.
Well, there you go. But you've got the excuse, because now, did you grow up in America?
I grew up in America. Yeah.
Well, there we go. The soccer thing. Surely that wasn't such a thing.
It wasn't. So, well, it is now, weirdly, but it wasn't then. I mean, I don't think I played a game of it until I was in sixth grade, and it was just gym class.
So, when did you come over? What inspired you to? And why the hell did you come here? Sorry, I shouldn't have maybe phrased it quite like that.
I came over in 1990 for the first time. Having met my wife in New York City. I followed her back over.
I see.
She told me to go back a couple of times. And I clung on.
And when we find you here in 1999 and 2000, you are not... are you writing at all at this point? Or is this pre-journalism
thing? It's just starting. I mean, what you've missed out is the most momentous decade of my life, where, you know, I was had a dead-end job in New York, and then suddenly I had 3 kids and... and a job, and I was living in a foreign country, and I was just, you know, talk about how did I get here? I think the first article I ever wrote for a publication in the popular press was for GQ magazine in like the end of 1995 or 96. And they had a section at the back. They just called me out of the blue and said, would you, you know, like to write an article for us? And I thought, you know, this kind of phone conversation you always imagine happening. But you think, surely it should have been me that picked up the phone. They can't, you know, it can't be that my reputation in data entry has preceded me this far.
But how did they find you then?
This is the thing, I didn't know. So I just said, oh, yeah, sure, that sounds great. And I'd written a few things for like trade magazines on and off, just kind of subbing for people and stuff and doing a bit of editing. But nothing big and nothing in a while. And they said, we have a column at the back called Man Enough, and it's a different person every month, and we'd like you to write one. How do you feel about that? And I said, sure. and it became clear that the Man Enough column was, they'd come up with a bunch of, you know, Man Enough to do this, Man Enough to do that. And this one was called Man Enough to Live Off Your Girlfriend. And once they'd got a big list, they went in search of people who fit the bill. And obviously someone at some editorial meeting somewhere said, I know a dude just like that. So it was the first thing I ever wrote for them. And on the cover, when it came out, it said, Rent Boy, How to Live Off Your Girlfriend. It's like, I can't send my mother an article about how I'm a pimp in London.
How's it going over there, darling?
Well, read this.
That's quite a dream scenario. What was that phone call like? And did you play it cool with the phone call? Were you like, I'll see what I can
played
do?
I played it slightly too cool because I was so confused. I didn't, yeah. I thought, for fully halfway through, I was convinced they'd rung up the wrong person, but I could still somehow land this gig.
Yeah.
It'd be too late, but it was a friend of a friend. She's a friend of mine now. She works at the Telegraph. And it started quite a long relationship with GQ.
Right.
I wrote for them for sort of 3 or 4 years after okay. that.
And did you always want to be a writer? Was that always the idea? Or was data entry really your passion?
Data entry was... I sort of mastered data entry by then, I felt. When I was very young, I wanted to be a cartoonist.
Aha. Uh-huh.
And I was obsessed with... I loved, New Yorker cartoons. Yeah. And I actually did it for a job for a while, around that time, around 1999, but I couldn't make it pay.
No.
And as far as being, bad at something, I thought being a failed journalist was better than being a failed cartoonist because the overheads are lower.
Yeah.
But having to buy paper and stuff like that and ink.
Ink is expensive.
Then not being able to sell anything was... ridiculous.
So are you not tempted now when you've got your, I'm going to put this out there. It's a pretty iconic column that you've got in The Guardian and people love it. Are you not tempted now to scribble a little cartoon alongside it? Is that something you'd think about doing or is that gone?
Not for a long time. I had a brilliant illustrator called Benoit Jacques who would sort of end the idea that I would ever do it. From time to time, people found it because I used to actually have a little portfolio. Over the course of my career, people would find out that I'd done them and they would say, oh, send them in. And then I would send them in and they would quietly send them back. And that'd be the end of that. I do scribble all the time. I mean, my sort of desk blotter is covered in little scribbles.
Yeah.
But I haven't. It's something I think that something about writing, especially writing that column, has kind of scratched that itch. And I've sort of stopped doing it as compulsively as I used to. I used to draw really compulsively.
Right. Okay. So cartoonist, data entry, and then we see in 2001, you've done it. You're not the first on this podcast to do this. You've bought your own produce on Amazon. Congratulations.
I did.
Well done. You've got two copies of Inventor of the Disposable Culture, King Camp Gillette, 1855 to 1932. Oh, okay. Tell us about this book.
I thought you meant fresh veg.
The produce that you are organically growing is writing, and you've done it again in April as well. April 2001. Well, two copies.
They're really cheap. I think you've probably had previous guests who tell you that when you got a book coming out, you just want to make sure that whole Amazon system is up and running.
Sure,
and
yes.
The easiest way to do that is just to fire one through the system and make sure it comes to your house.
Like if you're not getting any emails, send yourself an email.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. Exactly. And then send yourself another one to make sure it's still working. And then why not check to see what happens if buying one? How does that affect the Amazon ranking if you just buy one? Anything?
That's pretty good. Oh, okay. Might buy some more.
My matey bought a toaster.
What else have we got here in 2001? Good Times, Explicit Lyrics by Afro Man. Isn't that the guy who did...
Then I Got High.
Because I got high. Or as it says on the front, of this album, featuring the hot joint, Because I Got High. Also includes She Won't Let Me, Tall Cans, Mississippi, Tumbleweed, ideas for future columns here, Tim. Let's All Get Drunk.
I'm slightly ashamed to share that I brought that for my children.
What?
To play in the car.
This was sort of thing we used to
advisory. All walk around the house going, then I got high. And I thought, I'll buy it for the car. It'll be fun on long car journeys. But the lyrics are tremendously explicit.
They were problematic then. So,
I don't think I played it more than once in the car. And even then, not all the way through.
Is there anything better, though, than when you find a song or a moment or a thing and you're all you and the kids... You're in the car together going off on a holiday or something, all singing along. It's a proper sort of, I don't know, it's just, it always strikes me as a genuine happy moment.
They're very hard to find, those songs. I remember one, we had one that we used to call the Cool Fun Tape. And it was something that I bought at a clothing shop in America. And it was basically sort of 50s and 60s doo-wop hits and old, and like Danny and the Juniors playing Do You Want to Dance and stuff like that. Brilliant for that sort of thing. And we played it until it wore out. And then I tried to make a tape, a mixtape, which I called the Cool Fun Tape, with a tremendous amount of arrogance on my part, which I was the only person who thought it was either cool or fun.
Oh, I know, but isn't it nice when you're dad and you decide what's cool and fun, and then they get to an age where that is the exact opposite
the of worst.
What's cool and fun. Yeah, yeah. You still have that moment.
We used to always make the mistake of only going on... Well, it turned out not to be a mistake, but we'd sort of search ourselves and our luggage the second we got somewhere and realized that we'd only brought one CD for the whole holiday between us. So we just listened to that the whole time. And it would become this kind of favorite where everyone in the car knew all the words to every song.
Yeah.
And that's quite good. I mean, maybe the year that it was Scouting for Girls wasn't so good.
Yeah. But, oh, come on. Scouting for Girls.
I was a terrible con. I mean, it's very hard when you come back to London. You go, hey, you know, this new group, Scouting for Girls, is pretty cutting edge.
Yeah. Guys, who's with me?
Guys.
Anyone?
One year was the Felice Brothers, I remember.
Oh, yeah.
That was very good. And then They Might Be Giants.
One of my favorite bands of all time.
Yeah, fantastic.
Flood is, and again, something I've talked about at length on this podcast before. Flood is just the finest album ever made. Sorry, it's better than Sgt. Pepper's. I'm just going to put it out there.
Flood is the last record I bought as an actual LP before the whole system disintegrated. I brought it to London with me, and there was nothing to play it on anywhere.
Yeah. It's a brand new record for 1990. Let's not dwell on how long ago that is. It always strikes me about that album that my brilliant brother, bought that for me for my 10th birthday, right? And
did he?
And it set me up, and that got me into music, and it made me an indie kid, and it got me up and running. And it was my 40th the other day, and he bought me a yoga mat. And I just, I see the arc. I see the journey.
He's ahead of you every step of the way.
I do feel
foresight.
That. In every sense, he is. Have you ever seen They Might Be Giants live?
Yes. And I went to the, I've seen them twice. And the second time I saw them, I think it was both times at the Shepherd's Bush Empire. And the second time I saw them, I got invited to the after party. By someone who knew their manager. And I think I was too nervous to say anything but hello to either of them. I talked to their manager for a long time about lead paint or something. He was obsessed with lead and petrol.
That's a massive tangent. The lead and petrol that wasn't it originally put there?
Yeah.
So when they unleaded it, they were only ever correcting a thing they artificially put in.
Although I think you pay more for that somehow. I think just to charge you more, they put it back in and then take it out. It was to stop what they called engine knocking.
That's it.
You could buy like super leaded. And
I'm just imagining this chat. They Might Be Giants inches away from you.
Yeah.
One of my favorite bands.
I couldn't get
talking
past
about
this guy and his conversation about lead. He basically was saying that they're taking lead out of petrol in the United States and taking lead out of the paint that they used to paint walls was responsible for the precipitous drop in crime across the United States throughout the 1990s.
Yes.
Because people who had reached criminal age by 1990 had not been driven mad by eating so much lead.
By lead. Now, I have to ask, was this him telling you this?
Him telling me this.
Oh, my God. I mean, you must have just been standing there going, it's John and John from They Might Be
Giants.
I
know Phil Jupitus was there as well. I could have met a lot of people.
Oh, I love Phil Jupitus. God, that's the worst night of my life. Sort of conversational bouncer keeping you out of the VIP section. Nightmare. All right, Tim, let's skip on ahead now. Here's a good one. October 2003. Now.
Yes.
Understanding chord progressions for guitar and 100 tips for blues guitar. It's not a midlife crisis, is it? Because you're a musician, right?
I'm not a musician in that sense. I mean, basically all my Amazon purchases could be boiled down into legitimate business expenses and everything else. Mm-hmm. And none of the music stuff counts as a legitimate business expense yet.
No, I see.
And I see.
So the music's still to come.
I remember being very disappointed with both those books, thinking these aren't helping me at all. At that time, I did play the guitar in a very desultory fashion, like most people.
Right. But that's now become a slightly more serious part
of your
life.
Yes, that had yet to happen then.
Okay.
But it had. It did.
Okay. We'll get to it. Save that gold. I mean, we could talk about all sorts in 2004. Maybe the Nikon US E6 USB cable.
Well, that was
for the 2100, a classic
one of the
cable.
Best. of the cables. Yeah. But just cabling is one of those things that I was so relieved not to have to go out and get. I mean, I remember driving round and around with an infant in the car looking for a specific sort of printer cable that you could only get at PC World out on the A5. And it's one of those places, like sort of lost place. Every time you took the exit, it would just kind of spit you out somewhere else, and you could never access the actual PC World car park.
Are you a road rager in that situation?
I was at that time. But I mean, it was more, I was angry with myself, ultimately.
Well, I mean, listen, let's not get too profound, but isn't all road rage just self-anger?
Yeah.
Really?
When it falls down I find it. If you have an infant in the back seat, then technically you're not talking to yourself.
No.
So, you know, you're thinking, look at him, this idiot.
So now your kids are older, you just need to find an infant to drive around with. You'll feel fine.
Just, you know, 3 times a week, just to Waitrose and back.
Please, I need someone to listen. I still love you, baby, I don't want you for the rest of my day. I won't ever say we're
through. I won't. Get yourself some gas and air and breathe deeply.
We're talking on the phone while he had his arm inside my vagina.
In my head, I was saying, could you go and see if the anaesthetist is free? And what I was actually saying out loud was, help me!
CD player doesn't work. I was like, I'm sorry! Why am I fucking CD player? Where's my playlist?
That's One Torn Every Minute with me, Beth Murray. Available now from Great Big Owl.
Help me!
Oh, I bought so many embarrassing things. Pink CDs and a toddler that sings.
What about this theory of poker? A professional poker player teaches you how to think like what I... Do you know what? You have just done the poker news.
Is that Slansky? Is it called Slansky?
Yeah. That's it, Slansky. And there's another one, Poker Texas Hold'em, A Complete Guide to Playing the Game. There was a real craze for poker around this time.
Those both, by the way, are legitimate business expenses.
Sure, of course.
I remember one of the big off online betting firms that, when I say they're online, but they're also offshore, you know, they're located in the Isle of Man or somewhere. Paid for me to go to a big poker tournament in Dublin to write a feature for, I think, The Telegraph. And I said, you know, I really don't know how to play poker, and I especially don't know how to play Texas Hold'em. And this was a pot limit Texas Hold'em tournament, which I now know what that means, but at the time I had no idea. And I sort of...
What does that mean?
Pot limit means that you can the most you can bet in any go is how much is in the pot at that moment.
There's no
limit hold'em where you can just bet as much as you've got. So
this is a conservative sort of
slightly more conservative, although things build quickly. And I don't hear people talk about pot limit hold'em anymore. Maybe I think it's all gone, no limit now. But that's I could be showing my ignorance there. But I remember distinctly, you know, desperately reading, landing at the airport, still reading this book at the luggage carousel, and suddenly realizing that I'm surrounded by professional poker players from London who are picking up their luggage. And I'm reading a sort of, you know, grade one, chapter one of a sort of poker for morons book in front of them all. And they're all going to see me.
Well, that's good hustling. That's good hustling, maybe. That's the ultimate poker face.
It turns out it wasn't. I lost in the first, I lost the first table after about 40 minutes of very conservative play. I bet, and I was suddenly out.
How much did you lose?
Well, I don't know. The stake, I mean, I think the stake would have cost something like £5,000. I don't know. I can't remember. A lot. Between £2,000 and £5,000. But the poker people were paying for me. So I lost. I didn't lose any of my money. And technically, I don't think I lost any of their money.
The poker people, they sound like great friends. Like, are you still in touch with the poker people?
Yeah, they're good guys. Who I'm still in touch with, it was sort of terrible drowning our sorrows night afterwards that ended very shabbily. And he was from the PR company that was there to sort of look after me. And we both, you know, recall it as a horrible, horrible evening. Also, poker people are pretty horrible. I mean, I've met some nicer ones,
yes.
That sort of, especially people who kind of watch poker, you know, there's like a little stand there where you can sit and watch the match.
What?
Not big, but those sort of 16 chairs where people could just sit there and watch you play.
Wow. That's insane. Because obviously poker channels are huge where they do the same thing. They watch and they've got like cameras underneath the table.
So this, I think they do all that in a truck because this was in an actual casino. I mean, it's a miserable way to spend a summer day in Dublin. I don't think I'd ever been to Dublin before.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
You know, I had about an hour of walking around Dublin before I would have to go and sit in this casino all day long. Because I was writing the feed, you know, I had to stay and write about the match as a whole and interview a bunch of poker players.
Have you done a lot of these sort of trips where you have to dive into a random world for a feature? Is that something very common for writers?
Yes. Well, I do it. I mean, I think at the beginning I used to get a lot of those gigs precisely because I showed genuine fear and reluctance, which is hard to fake.
Ironically, your poker face wasn't good enough at the meeting.
I mean, I remember the first sort of big one that I did for The Guardian was the then editor of the features editor rang me up and he said, at the time there was a BBC reality TV show called The Trench, which was about a bunch of people whose ancestors had been in World War I in the trenches. Mm. And they'd built a trench somewhere in a field in France and they were going to live in it for 6 weeks.
Yeah, I remember.
So he said, what we want to do, and I'd listened to this whole while he explained the whole thing to me. So what we're going to do is come and dig a trench in your back garden and you're going to live in it for 48 hours. And I said, no. And he said, absolutely not. I'm not doing that. And then he said, as he always said, I'll call you back in 10 minutes. And he just let that sort of 10 minutes of worry work on me.
Is that what he's doing? Because he knows, God, that is brutal.
So that was one of them. I once spent 24 hours in a glass box suspended above the Guardian car park because David Blaine was doing the same thing.
Because of David Blaine.
Got in there just ahead of him, yeah.
Hang on, what did you do about Wheeze and Poos when you did that? Come on. What happened there?
I was very cagey about it at the time. In fact, they wouldn't let me be in it at the same time that it was off the ground for health and safety reasons. A lot of these things fall apart when you realize how much insurance David Blaine must be paying to be on a crane.
Yeah.
So I was like on a pallet in this glass. They built a Perspex box that you could live in 24 hours. They were amazing at that sort of thing.
Yes.
But they actually lobbed the screwdriver over the top because mine had no ceiling. That would have cost too much. So someone threw me a screwdriver. So by shimmying up one corner, I could reach down the outside and undo two screws and just slip through the crack.
Right.
Which I did to go to the loo at 2 o'clock in the morning once.
I see. Ah, now we know the truth. It wasn't 24 hours. you know, the thing which I loved about David Blaine was when he was up there, someone found a really good position. I think it was on Tower Bridge, maybe, where they could hit golf balls and they actually, I think three of them actually struck in the middle of the night. David Blaine got woken up.
They sort of flew Big Macs on helicopters around him, didn't they? On little model helicopters.
It was so strange. And
I interviewed him once, actually. He was quite a weird guy.
No, you don't say. How on earth? Where did you interview him? What context?
It must have been his stunt after, I mean, it's probably two stunts after that, because I remember seeing him in New York when he was in the ice. I just happened to be there doing something else. Right. And I would walk by him being in the ice every day on my way. And then I think he was underwater. Didn't he,
live
underwater for...
Yeah.
And then at the end of that, he tried to break the static apnea record, I believe it was called. Mm. And I interviewed him as that was coming out, after he'd done it. His fingers were all still peeling.
Oh, gosh.
All the skin is peeling off his hands. And I remember the photographer wanted to photograph him in the hotel bathroom.
Right.
Which he absolutely agreed to.
That's not
he
what
lay
I was
down
expecting
on his back underwater for minutes on end while the photographer straddled the tub and took vertical shots of him lying there.
What, the man who'd just been underwater?
Yeah.
Was happy to go back in. That's brilliant. Oh, my God. Here's a good one. 15th of October 2005, Tim Dowling. A lovely cast iron omelette pan. That's a classic number there. £25 there you spent on that.
What radius is that? What diameter?
Great question. And this is the kind of detail we like to get into on this show. 20 centimetres, matte black.
Small.
Small. I mean, it's a small omelette.
It's a very small omelette. I've still got that one, though.
An omelette for one, maybe. I don't know.
I think so.
Not got great reviews, actually.
Too small.
Well, maybe. Jerry, I bought this as a replacement for my 20-centimetre non-stick pan that I use for making pancakes, but found that residue was building in the pan as I made the pancakes, which meant the pancakes were not finishing as cleanly as I'm used to. I also found the handle a bit too
small. Welcome to cast iron, mate. Welcome to the world of cast iron.
There you go. And the handle gets hot, doesn't it? This is the problem.
He had to discover all this for himself.
Yeah,
that's
exactly. Yeah, this is why we shouldn't have Amazon reviews. We need to make these mistakes organically in our lives.
No.
Someone else has given it one star. I've used this pan for fried eggs and omelettes, both of which stick terribly to the surface, irrespective.
Did they not read the seasoning manual that came with it?
Well, exactly.
You've got to season a pan.
You've got to work a pan in before you start using it. Are you much of a cook? Because you bought a few cookbooks around here, actually. You've got Nigel Slater, The Kitchen Diaries here.
That's a very good book.
Yeah.
I am more now than I used to be. My wife, at the sort of beginning of lockdown, my wife just said, I'm never cooking again, by the way. And she meant it. And I sort of didn't take it very seriously. I thought she meant you're cooking tonight, by the way. But she meant from now on. And she does not go anywhere near it.
Is she stuck by it?
Yep. She buys the food. She sometimes cleans up afterwards, mostly cleans up afterwards. But she does not cook nothing. So
Why did she suddenly do this?
I think she thinks it's boring.
I mean, she's probably right.
She's
I suppose
boring, it's boring, and she's not interested. She never has been interested, and she doesn't want to do it anymore.
Wow.
So but I've suddenly realized what that means, because, you know, I used to be like the fun cook who came in and made something quite show offy and made a huge mess. And bought a new iron pan every time I needed one.
Yeah, they were disposable. Yeah. The iron pan, just chuck it in the bin.
Out.
Yeah.
Residue. So I see what she means. You know, it's an absolute grind having to do it again and again and again. And you tend to sort of fall back on quite tried and tested recipes that nobody's that excited about.
You do have a thing, don't you, where you have three or four things on a circuit.
Yeah, three.
You can fall into humdrummery very quickly, especially during lockdown. And I feel very lucky, because my wife, she says she loves cooking. She finds it therapeutic and she really enjoys doing it. And
that's good.
Well, I'm very lucky. Yeah,
you're lucky because can wear off.
I know.
I'm just going to say that might not last.
I'll keep an eye out for that. Thank you. This is good. You're very good. A good warning system for me. I'll keep an eye out for that. All right, let's skip on ahead. 2007. You have bought, and I love it when my guests buy music that I like. Not only do you like They Might Be Giants, but you've bought the brilliant Herman Dunes Giants.
That's another one of those exact things. I don't know what I must have been, like, the Guardian website or something, just or maybe Pop Bitch or something like that, just pointing the way to that video.
Yes.
That was such a thing. And from then on, I became an absolute diehard fan. And then so did my kids. And then I took two of them to a festival and Herman Dunes was playing. And they ran up to the front and went bananas. And the guy from Herman Dunes had never seen anything like it. And he came out. I don't think he expected to be recognized by anyone, you know. It was sort of afternoon set.
That's so great.
And they knew all the words to everything they played and were just stomping up and down.
Just brilliant. I think that was such a great band.
And that was another long car journey thing.
Yeah, yeah. So you did festivals then with the kids. That feels like something that's only happened more recently.
I did that once.
Okay, there's going to be a reason.
That was the time. And it was a disaster. I mean, apart from Herman Dunes, we got there just as darkness fell and the rain started. And there was no place big enough to put up our tent.
Oh, God, which festival?
What's Latitude.
Okay, yeah.
It's a good festival.
Of course. Latitude, yeah, of course.
But, you know, because it's a family tent, it has the footprint of a bouncy castle. I put the pole through the fly sheet. And as I stood up, I hurt my back. And I spent the rest of the festival basically lying on some grass, moaning, with my children pulling me by the arms, going, come on, we're going to miss this. I did that thing where they made me pour out all my wine on the way in.
The bouncers did?
Yeah, and I just thought, for me, I brought two nice bottles of red wine to sort of suck on. Luckily, I'd had the sense to pour one of them into a water bottle.
Yeah.
I just had this.
Kids, if you're listening, great tips.
Yeah. Really gross warm bottle of red wine that I just go back to my tent and suck on.
I mean, Can you imagine the what I love about that is if you go to somewhere like Glastonbury and you've got too much booze, it's people pouring away, you know, Diamond White Cider or something. Yeah. If you go to Latitude, everyone's like, oh, but this this red wine's a Chateau. Really, do I have to? Not my port.
I somehow imagine it was only going to just be me, but it was everyone.
Oh, that's great.
And the thing is, when you've got little kids, they're useless. You don't say, well, daddy's hurt his back, so you're going to have to carry everything. They can't carry anything. So they had to sort of pile it on me like a donkey.
Oh,
because once I was up straight and upright, it was fine. So they just kind of slung it all over me like a Christmas tree, and I sort of waddled back to the car.
And the irony is, it's the kids that do you back in the first place.
Yeah, absolutely. They just watched me. I remember them watching me like I was a sort of insufficiently diverting cartoon as I sort of ripped the tent to shreds, hurt my back, swore, and they just kind of staring at me from a lump of nettles.
Oh, God. Oh, kids are just born to destroy us, aren't they? Yeah. That's what they do.
That's what they do.
You've bought November. You've bought the Giles Waring Haters Club by
Tim Dowling.
Very good book. And then in December, you've bought the Giles Waring Haters Club by Tim Dowling.
Yeah,
and then
I gave both of them 4 stars.
Oh, did you? Not even 5. For goodness sake.
I don't want to get caught.
And also in December, Suspicious Packages and Extendable Arms by Tim Dowling.
Tim Dowling.
So obviously, Christmas time is a great time for your friends and family to get some Tim Dowling books.
I still have those copies. Yeah, I can't give that stuff away. Again, I was just testing the system.
Yes.
To make sure it worked. And it was sort of amazing to have 2 books out in 1 year. But one of those, I think, is a collection of stuff from The Guardian.
Right.
I know it is. I know exactly what's in it. I know what's in both of them.
Yeah.
And the other one is a novel. And that was the same year. I mean, I just thought, you know, you have really hit the big time. And of course, both those books tanked completely. Nobody bought them except me.
Do you want to write another one? What's the plan book-wise? Because when was your last book?
2017, I want to say, something like that.
Okay. And what's the plan? Is there a new one on the way?
There's a sort of vague, I've got a project for when I don't have anything else to do, which is a novel. But I sort of don't tell anyone about it because I don't want to set the clock ticking and I don't want someone to say, I don't want to show it to anyone yet, as it were.
Otherwise,
it becomes a thing where you have to start actually working on it.
Yeah. Oh, well, I'm just going to start relentlessly tweeting you asking about how the new novel's
going.
Actually. This podcast is the starting pistol. January 2008 now, Tim. How to Talk About Books You Haven't Read by Pierre Bayard. That feels good for me. Someone who's done an English degree, people always think.
Unfortunately, I didn't read that book either.
The book. You need a York Notes for that one. It's an issue. All right, good. Oh, look at this. 2009 now. West London Joint Railways.
Oh,
Lord. Yeah. What's going on here, please?
Is that a legitimate business expense or not? Probably not. So that is another failed project, which I thought I was going to write a novel at that point, which would be heavily thematically centered on the lost rivers of London.
Oh.
Specifically one called Counters Creek, which no one's ever heard of because it was quite small and it's been lost for a long time.
When they're lost, are they filled in or are they still flowing underground somewhere?
Well, I can only speak for Counters Creek, but I can tell you exactly. It flows through a sewer pipe about 100 or 200 metres north of where the old bed was.
That's so sad. It's like river prison.
Yeah. I mean, if you know where the sort of where Lotts Road power station is.
Mm-hmm.
In Chelsea, that's where it came out.
Right.
And otherwise it ran due north, or it ran south, as it were.
Okay. So that's... I like the way this is becoming a litany of failed projects.
Well, I'm sorry about that.
No. It's great. It's a great listen. Everyone loves failure.
Well, I'm here for you then.
Yeah.
So I think the West London Railway was built on top of part of it. And, you know, it's... Sometimes that's the thing about Amazon is you think, do I need to go to the library and look at this book or do I need to buy and own this book? And it's all a question of price and time. It's like,
This was only £3.59.
So obviously by the time I get to the library, I've already spent more money than that.
Oh yeah, good. See, good.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know whether I still have that book, but
great. The economics of being a writer.
Mm.
Brilliant, brilliant.
Can I afford to just own all this stuff and then throw it away later?
Did you have that feeling when lockdown kicked in, looking at your Oyster card and all the money you'd saved by not travelling for £8 a day on London Underground? I feel like I've won the lottery.
Not me, not so much, because I don't. I've been preparing for lockdown for like 12 years. Basically,
okay, right, I see. Yeah,
I never go anywhere, and I wash my hands all the time anyway.
Yeah, and you've got a trench.
So I work in a shed in my back garden, and it's always a terrible chore if I have to get on the tube and go somewhere. So right. I what I noticed was that I was suddenly surrounded by people. You know, everybody else used to go to work all day, and now I can hear. In the summer, you can hear through the open windows everybody at their sort of basically office in their house, sitting at their kitchen table with their laptop open, talking really loudly on the phone to someone.
Well, I mean, they're not a Zoom call; they're a Boom call.
Yeah, yeah.
They're
really loud.
I walking the dog the other day, walked past someone having a Zoom call in their front room with the window wide open, just talking in corporate man speak.
I heard the exact same thing the other day, and the person who was on the computer was louder than the person. Who was in the room.
Maybe I saw the other end.
Broadcasting, really shooting out. It was amazing.
Yeah. Let's put that up the flagpost. Yeah, okay.
Because that person has no idea how far and wide their voice is being broadcast.
Yeah.
They're just sitting in their shed with no trousers on.
The world knows.
Talking nonsense.
I have found it hard because I, like you, I spend a lot of time at home. You know, a podcaster's lot and a presenter's lot is to spend a lot of time at home. And finding other people around... I don't like sharing my airspace with them at all. My neighbours, I now know way too much.
Mm.
You know, I know that the new neighbour over the way at the back showers in the middle of the day and likes to have a sort of pre-shower naked walk just to, I don't know why.
Just to air dry.
It's a pre-shower thing. I mean, I know this much detail about him. I find it very hard. I don't like other people, but I live in London. It's a tricky one.
It is tricky. I mean, I get embarrassed about how little... I actually do in the day.
Mm.
And the whole brilliant thing about working from home was that it was long, one big disgusting secret and nobody had to know. And now you just think, I'm sort of ducking to make sure I'm low enough behind the hedge on my way out, you know.
What we're going to do now, we're going to skip ahead to 2010. We have got still loads more books here. Nigel P. Farage, Fighting Bull. Is that actually a book he's written or is that a piss take?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I'm sure he, you know, it's his book. I don't know whether he had a ghostwriter. I think he wrote it, actually.
Right.
And I'm pretty sure I read it.
Actually read it?
I read the whole thing, yeah. Because I, in 2010, right? Is that what you said?
Yeah.
2010? Yeah. Yeah, in 2010, that was the election. And I followed him around for 2 days.
Oh, wow.
And it was for a long piece that never ran.
Oh, why was that? Why did it never run?
Well, I never asked. But I mean, it was during the election. It was for the front of the paper, and there were lots of these articles swirling around. There were lots of people on the campaign trail filing things. And if you sort of recall spring of 2010, that's when Nick Clegg was the sort of magic man.
Mm-hmm. I agree with Nick.
Yeah, the Lib Dems were a huge deal, and I just think that they thought that the whatever 2,500 words I'd expended on Nigel Farage wasn't worth it. He just wasn't that big a deal. He had no chance. He was standing against the Speaker.
Oh yes, I remember that race.
where none of the other main parties stand, you know, to give him a clear run. So it was him and a guy dressed as a dolphin.
Yeah,
and the dolphin beat him. I think. I mean, he may have lost his deposit. I can't remember.
Yes, I think he's certainly lost every time he's attempted to become an MP in this country.
Also, he was in that plane crash right before the election.
Yeah.
So he was in hospital. I went back and did write an article about the count.
Right. So
I went to Aylesbury Civic Centre for the count or whatever it's called. And he wasn't there because he was in hospital.
Wow. Because that flight was part of the build up to the election, was it? That was a...
He got into a little tiny light aircraft with, you know... Obviously, always, if you're going to trust any pilot, trust an amateur UKIP supporting pilot. They're sure to bring you down safe.
They don't need experts on things like how to fly a plane.
So I don't think he'd gone very high, but I think he did get quite badly hurt.
He did. No, I remember. It was quite the image of him walking away from the wreckage.
That's
awful.
Right, with blood on his face. Yeah. So the 2 days following him around was odd, but you know, I don't know. I guess in hindsight, felt like a waste. I've any anecdote I can remember for it, I drag out whenever I can, because I still want credit for spending all that time with him.
What is the thing that stands out for you, your time with him? What best sums him up then?
He then, as now, he was kind of a knack for saying the same thing over and over and over again. You know, he kept saying, "We're going to light a bomb under British politics." And every time they turned a camera on in front of him, he would say it. And every time he shook someone's hand, he would say it. But when he was away from all that, he had a sort of dry wit.
Yeah.
And he was quite friendly. And he was a little bit taken aback. I think he got a lot of stick on the doorstep because people felt it's a very sort of Tory, genteel sort of bit of the world.
Mm.
And they felt that he'd been very rude to the leader of the EU Parliament at the time. You remember he called him a wet dish rag or something.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And so they had a lot to say to him. They were quite displeased with him. And I wouldn't say he was unruffled by it. He took it on the chin, but I think the cumulative effect of going from doorstep to doorstep and having people say, "I'll never vote for you.
Great.
Your politics disgust me."
Oh, great.
Did sort of get him down after a while.
Oh, that's lovely to hear. Oh, that's really warming the cockles. Well, this is one of the great things, one of the solace that I take from the likes of Boris and Farage. They are populists. They want to, Boris is a turn. He wants to be popular.
And they want to be liked.
They want to be liked. And he's not. You know, I live very near to where he used to live, and everyone around here thinks he's a massive fucking asshole. And yet when he was mayor, I remember going past him playing tennis, and I was like, all right, Mr. Mayor, you know, yeah. I loved it. He was a bit of a novelty, you know, middle of the ground, safe Tory. And now he's loathed, unsurprisingly.
Well, populism really doesn't suit anyone when there's stuff actually going wrong, does it?
No, that's right. Terrible. It's not good with facts.
The thing that freaks me out about those guys, especially Nigel Farage. Nigel Farage is a year younger than me.
Oh, don't tell
me that.
I
just think, how did you get like that? I mean, the clothes that you wear, they weren't available.
Yeah.
In my youth,
it's ridiculous, isn't it? It's a fancy dress costume, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
Rees-Mogg as well. Rees-Mogg's is about 32.
I know, I can't. I don't understand. I don't know, where do you buy those things?
It's just so depressing.
I mean, you see those shops in country towns, don't you?
That's what they do. They think
the windows are all sort of dusty, and you think no one goes in there.
Yeah, it's them, just Rees-Mogg at the back, just buying some tweed, which is still damp from the 1830s. Beyond belief. Now, I'm seeing the theme of music building up. Oh, look, Wilson Duke replica American football, November 2013. You got that for Thanksgiving or?
Yeah, I mean, I think we would have gone to America for something and then they would have decided that they wanted to play football forever.
Mm-hmm.
And I would have said, okay, fine. And then that would have just sat behind a door somewhere.
Classic, a classic family story. Another classic. Heartwarming family story. Yeah, yeah. But we see music coming along here. The 2.5 strength reeds for the B flat clarinet. Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Pack of five reeds there.
I bought my Amazon purchases are but a fraction of the rubbish I buy off the internet, and I found a secondhand clarinet for like £30.
Yeah,
and I thought, you know, it's one of those things when you're looking at it, you think, playing the clarinet, how hard can it be?
Hard.
And it turns out,
yeah,
it's really hard. Also, because it's secondhand, it has, you know, everything is damaged. So that was my sort of bid to kind of put it back together, get some new reeds. I think I got one of those cloths that you ran through it to clean the gunk out.
I'm looking at it. Yeah, it's here. I can see that exact thing. You have bought where is it now? Hang on one sec. You bought a clarinet pull-through cleaning cloth. That looks like a satisfying bit of clarinet admin.
It's a cloth with a bit of string at one end, so you can hold, the string falls through and you can just pull it through.
I mean,
clarinet is one of those instruments that has a lot of saliva involved, like the trumpet or any of those things. And it's kind of, you know, the reed gets very soggy. After a while, you think, and also it's exhausting. I would have to lie down after 10 minutes.
Why? Because of the blowing?
Yeah, the blowing. Because the blowing is like, you know, you're blowing, but you're also compressing the reed with your teeth and lips.
God,
to let as little air through as possible so that you get that clarinet sound.
Oh, yeah.
And it's, you know, it's like one of those things you do to faint on purpose.
I never ever thought about lung fitness required.
Oh, yeah. And also just stamina.
I really pick up on the saliva thing. I'll be honest, I'm not a fan of saliva. And I've had this problem since childhood. I can remember doing, someone tried to get me into the trumpet as a kid, and before they handed it over to me, they poured the saliva of some other kids out of the shared trumpet. And I was like,
here you go.
I am out. I am out for life.
I think it would be, the thing is, if you gave someone a new trumpet, it would be weeks before you had to tell them about the spit that has to be emptied out of it.
Yeah.
Just to do it in front of them first time.
Right in front of me, like a torture. Yeah. Look at this.
No.
Saliva. No. It's...
Well, I can't recommend the clarinet then either.
I just realised my least favourite word in the English language is saliva. I'm thrilled with that. Right, okay, I won't take up the clarinet. Good. All right, come on, we're going to rush through because we're running out of time. There's so many things I want to talk about here, Tim. And what I'm going to do, in fact, I'm just going to have a sort of speed run, okay?
Okay.
You're just going to have to give me some quick kind of, you know, like almost non-verbal responses to these, maybe even noises. July 2015, you've bought the Vango inflatable camping sofa. So you're into your camping then?
It's partly a festival thing. It's got playing at festivals.
Mm.
A lot of them you have to camp if you're playing twice, or if you're playing, you know, at night, you can't get home. So
yes.
And I'm very into that kind of blow up camping furniture, but they're effectively disposable.
Right. Okay.
A blow up camping sofa lasts one camping trip.
Much like an omelette pan. They get too much stuff sticking to them, and then they've got to be binned off. That's something we meant to talk about, because I can see here as well the contemporary banjo player. Tell us about how music has come into your life by this point and what you're up to.
I think it was 2007 or 8 that my wife bought me a banjo for my birthday, mm-hmm. and I struggled with it very much for a while. Man versus banjo, really. And I was sort of getting to grips with it when a friend of mine who'd been in bands all through his youth had started playing with friends of his again.
Right.
I went to see them, and in that way that you think, I'm doing you such a giant fucking favor to come to see your band. What a good friend I am. By the end of the gig, I was like, I have to get in on this.
Wow.
And they were really good, and it was sort of, everybody else on the bill was a sort of male singer-songwriter with an acoustic guitar. And they just had this kind of three-part harmony worked out and arrangements for instruments. And I thought, this sounds really cool, and I can do this. They don't know what a banjo is supposed to sound like.
But did you have any experience with the banjo?
But by that point, I'd been playing it, you know, for about a year using internet lessons, but not really. No past experience with the banjo.
Wow. But so hang on, or any guitar experience?
I can play guitar a bit, but I've never taken the guitar as seriously as I then set about trying to learn the banjo.
I wasn't expecting this, Tim. I'm feeling slightly inspired by this.
You've
gone from zero to in a band, going around festivals doing gigs. This is quite significant.
Festivals, yeah. I mean, whenever our year off has turned into 2 years thanks to coronavirus, mm-hmm. but the last gig we played the Shepherd's Bush Empire.
Holy!
Where I saw They Might Be Giants. I was through. They had our name on the marquee and everything. It was amazing.
Look, you've gone full circle. You can go back there. You can get in the VIP room and not have to talk about lead in paint.
I went. We had an after party. They charge you for that, by the way.
That's great. That's great.
We had an after party. My wife lost all the tickets for everyone, so I had to go and hunt around and get more.
Just let everyone in. Go ahead, let them in. It's my thing. And we see the pro here. Look, you can tell you're a performer. Vocal Zone Throat Pastels, the finest. If you have a sore throat, even if you're not a performer, Vocal Zone are the best things you can possibly have.
Yes. They're incredible. I think it was my turn, because everybody in the dressing room kind of, they sort of remember when you keep borrowing one off them, you know? So I thought, I'll get a big pack.
Yeah. Well, there we go. And you are performing now, still buying loads of books as well. We have got, what else have we got here? Oh, look, come on. A storm lantern, kerosene lamp. That's nice. £30. Very nice for camping or?
Just for having. You know that thing when you, I don't know, we moved house about 3 years ago,
uh-huh.
and a bunch of my stuff went mysteriously missing.
Your wife threw it away, didn't she?
My wife just threw it away. And I put my foot down. I said, right, everything, there are certain things I said, I'm simply going to replace that at whatever it costs.
Right.
And one of those was that kerosene lamp and many, many, because she threw out all the wicks as well.
Right.
Extra wicks. You got to have extra wicks.
But where does the lamp go on the boat that you live
on? It sits on our sort of picnic table out on the sort of patio and never gets used for anything ever, mm-hmm. but it's there.
Mm-hmm.
That's still got it.
That's the point for a lot of Amazon purchasing though, isn't it? I get it. It sits there. It's not used, but the point is it's there.
Well, it's sort of impulse fury sometimes, isn't it, as well? Right. I'm just going to go out to my shed and I'm just going to buy another one.
Yeah. I'm going to get it out there.
And that, I'm going to get it. It's going to arrive really soon.
And no one's going to benefit from it, apart from me, knowing it's there.
Including me.
P.G. Woodhouse, Right Ho Jeeves. I mean, P.G. Woodhouse, come on.
Producer, yeah, that's book club.
Okay, nice. So you
muscled in on my wife's book club.
Now, here's the thing. I didn't realise book clubs are often just women only. My wife's in one and there's no men. And I was like, oh, I'd like to do that. And it's not allowed. It's almost as if men are a bit gobby and talk too much.
Yeah, well, that was the general feeling when I... But it was the first one, the inaugural one was at our house. And I was like, where am I supposed to go? And I said, what are we going to eat? She said, well, we're not eating. We're having book club. You fend for yourself. Right. So I sat in the other room until my wine glass was empty. And I thought, I need more wine.
Yeah.
And I went in there and I never left.
And did you sort of casually walk past and drop in an opinion on the book?
Yeah, I did. Well, the other thing was I'd read the book.
Well, actually, you're the only one, inevitably.
Which was... Far and away, that's a real try hard thing to do in book club. Is to say, I actually read the book.
Yeah,
it's not a requirement.
So how do you? I mean, I'm sorry to go on about the book club, but I'd like to be in a book club. How do you find them? And is it not just my wife's one? Is basically a tour of people's kitchens, often looking at side returns, never reading the book. Well, they get onto the book at about 11.
Yeah,
and then that's it.
This is like that, pretty much. Okay. I mean, my wife has two book clubs. One is a more serious book club, but I think she got into a conversation with some friends who'd never been in a book club. And she said, well, I'll just start one. You can all come to that.
Oh.
And she started one because she knows how book clubs work. That was the whole idea. And it's more about what are we having than what have we read.
Yes, I see.
It's like,
exactly.
Shall I do baked potatoes? Should we do this? You know, and then it gets very involved.
You see, the book should be Nigel Slater's cookbook that you bought.
Yeah.
That would be much more sensible.
Cookbook club
there
is a good idea.
That should happen. £120 on an eco barrow. This is in February 2019. That's an expensive wheelbarrow there.
It's a really good wheelbarrow. But I remember I had to have a discussion with the president of the company because it simply never arrived.
You have spoken to the president of Eco Barrow.
Yeah.
Did someone say putting you through to Mr. President?
I remember him telling me what went wrong. And he went, that's another story, but we won't go into that. I was like, please, I want to hear this.
Yeah. I need this for my column.
I guess, what do you do? I complained on Amazon because it never showed up.
Mm.
And the next thing I knew, I got an email from him and he included a number and said, please call me. So I rang him and he was he was furious and he said, don't worry, I'm sending you another one.
Wow.
And it's very, I mean... That's not the only reason I recommend the Eco Barrow to everyone.
Right.
But it's a very good, it's made of recycled material.
Okay. All right, that's nice to know. £120, wheelbarrow, good. Are you much of a gardener?
Very sturdy. We are, I mean, we are now. I mean, when I say we, my wife and I handle very separate parts of the garden so as not to tread on each other's sort of territory.
Mm-hmm. I see.
So I sort of do
Is yours
just vegetables.
A bit of lawn? Oh, yours is the vegetables. Okay, right.
And
right.
Lawn. I do lawn and vegetables and then she does virtually everything else.
Okay. Look at this. And now, right, here's what we're going to do now. Tim.
Okay.
And this is the reason you ended up falling into this trap and ending up on my podcast is because you wrote a brilliant column about how much stuff you've been buying during lockdown. Okay.
And it's okay.
And the random nature of things. And sure enough, these are all absolute classics. I mean, 27th of June 2020, the Westmark Cherry Stoner, a silver cherry stoner. If ever Amazon was invented for a brilliant product, is this.
I agree. And I can't really describe the number of hours I spent looking at different cherry stoners before I settled on that one.
Because cherry stoners.
You can spend a lot of money on it and you can find ones that do six cherries at once.
No.
There's one that bolts to the table and has a hopper, so it continuously stones cherries as you turn a crank.
Wow.
Which I was very interested in. But
very
was
interested,
like
yeah.
£37 or something.
Mm.
And I didn't want that. You know, when that things come through the door and your wife says, what is that? It's a £40 cherry stoner.
And? Your point being? Yeah. You don't even like cherries. That's not the point. So to describe it, it sort of looks like a stapler almost.
Yeah. It's like a spoon with a hole in it.
Yes. And then there's a kind of cross bit of metal coming down from the top of the stapler.
Yeah. It's like an opposing sort of hippo's tooth that comes down on the thing. And it works really, and it just feels like one of those things you almost want to search through your drawers because you think you might have your mother's old one or something.
Yeah.
And I didn't. So I thought, here's something I can pass on to my children.
Well, also, why this pleases me, and see above olives, is because there's a lot less saliva involved now. Yeah. You see, you haven't got the misery of watching someone
pull this around.
Oh, and then they same with olive stones. When they put there's a sort of olive stone or cherry stone bin on the table. So while I'm eating cherries, I'm going to look at your ex cherry mush in front of me.
The beauty of it is the cherry stone does olives as well.
Of course it does olives. Yeah. Right, I'm totally going to share that at ToasterPod on Twitter. The world has to know more about this.
I hope they have a huge supply of those.
There's about to be a serious rush on.
Where,
a serious
in
rush.
China, where they're all stored.
You bought a football. Yeah. Size 5, classic. How are the keepy uppies going? Are your kids still better than you?
They were totally adapted to a sort of flat donut shaped football over lockdown. So when I bought them that, they found that very, very bouncy now, because the other one, the dog had put a tooth through it. They were playing. It was very hard to watch. So I broke down and bought them another one. And Sichuan, they've kicked over all kinds of expensive plants.
Yeah, that's true. It's not good for the vegetable garden. Very annoying. The 8th of May, a multifunction pull-out kitchen faucet spray head replacement part. I mean, this is the kind of, I love this. This is Amazon at its best, really.
Absolutely. I mean, I don't collect stuff like that. It was broken. The old one was broken. And I spent, you know how long it takes to find the exact one. But I found it. It fits good.
And this is the thing. Here we go. Look, I'm going to end on the very item that you pretty much begin the piece on in The Guardian a couple of weeks ago, which is the plywood sheet, a wooden board with a hole cut to size, right?
Yeah.
And when you describe this in your article, I hadn't realised that this piece of wood, which is very underwhelming in the article, cost £54.90.
Yes.
That's expensive wood.
Yes. I dithered for a long time because of that. But that lockdown works its magic on you, doesn't it?
But what was it for?
It's one of my lockdown projects, which I have to admit is still far from complete, was a sort of mosaic tabletop made from broken china that I picked up in the park over many years while I was walking the dog.
Oh.
I have two big tins of it that I say, which turns out to be nowhere near enough. But yeah. I had some table legs, old Victorian table legs, but I needed a top. And in fact, plywood is not, you want a plywood base. And then on top of that, you want sort of cement shower curtain, shower wall.
Right.
I think it's called cement backer board.
Yeah.
And you glue those two together. But the plywood, the miracle of the plywood is that it's a company that they'll do you a circle of plywood any diameter you ask for.
I know. I mean, I know about this. The shares in that company are going through the roof after your article.
It's a miracle.
They do what? They cut wood into a circle. Darling.
Any diameter.
Invest. Take the shares out of Apple quickly.
And the amazing thing is they send you the bit of wood they cut it out of as well.
I know. It's absolutely brilliant. My wife had a similar thing. She made a mosaic tile table about 10, 11 years ago. And she still calls it her therapy table now because it kept her sane, I think.
Well, this one's driven me insane.
Right, it's gone the other direction. Well, listen, I'll leave you to get back to your therapy table. Tim Dowling, thank you for letting us, basically letting me go through your Amazon bins. It's been an absolute joy.
It turned out to be a pleasure. I was terrified.
Yeah, well, you shouldn't have been. It was really good fun.
I know.
Tim, thank you so much. What a pleasure to sort of meet you. And good luck with the table. Please do tweet a picture of the table when it's finished, if you could.
I will do.
Good. Oh, thank you so much, Tim. I'm a really big fan of yours. So I'm pleased to be well.
Fine. Thanks a lot.
Cheers,
all right,
mate.
Tom.
Bye now.
Cheers. Bye bye.
The fantastic Tim Dowling. I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. It's so nice when you're a fan of someone, and I've been a real fanboy of Tim Dowling's for years. He writes such funny, pithy, minimal columns every Saturday in The Guardian. It says something when people don't use many words, but you get everything about their world and their life, and you get the humour and the connections. He's a brilliant writer, brilliant observer. I mean, it's not in The Observer, it's in The Guardian. Shut up, Tom. Thanks for listening, team. I'll be back next week. If you like this show, and please give us a review. You know where to do that. And yeah, I'll see you soon. Bye-bye.
I'm Tilly Steele.
And I'm Helen Monk.
And this is Bitchin'.
I'm dyslexic. Yeah, why do you read the Wikipedia page?
It's good to practice.
A podcast where every week we talk about a different person.
So how old was he when he first popped on the scene?
That's a great
question. If you say he was my age, I'm gonna fucking die.
And we veer wildly off track.
Pop that Prosec.
Available on all your podcast apps. That's not my... just
can you not say in the advert?
Available on all your podcast platforms. Just search Bitchin' or Great Big Owl.
We'll see you there.
That was all right.